The other thing I want to say is just about this class. So in the last 8 weeks, we've been exploring the five great stages of spiritual life. I think they really are a description of what spiritual life is like in principle. That's not the right word. That's not the word I want, really. In essence, the heart of spiritual life. However you think about it, it needs to have... It has these stages. It has these five great stages, which I'll go through again tonight. These five great aspects that I'll go through tonight. Fairly easy to talk about. Actually, not even that easy to talk about sometimes. Fairly easy to talk about. But the main thing, of course, is to practice them. This is the idea, the vision, the spirit of these five stages is a complete path that leads you from integration to full and perfect enlightenment. We've followed that path, at least in our mind, and to some degree in experience. We've also been sharing our own experience. But the main thing is the practice of it. Sangharakshita, the founder of this movement, says an ounce of practice is worth a ton of theory. It's one of my favourite aphorisms of his. An ounce of practice is worth a ton of theory. In our modern Western world, we seem to have it the other way around, don't we? We seem to be so keen on theory. We seem to have a ton of theory and an ounce of practice. So that little aphorism there really is very sort of central to what Buddhism is. An ounce of practice is worth a ton of theory. So you've had a ton of theory. You have a bit more tonight. It's not all been theory. Theory is too bleak a word. But the next rest is practice. So I just really want to just encourage you to carry on coming to the class. I'm going off on retreat tomorrow with the LBC Council. Not tomorrow, on Saturday. So I won't be here next week. But just the class continues. Obviously, the class continues. I want to just encourage you to just keep coming. If you are to practice this path, you need, I need, we all need, people to practice it with, together. We need a whole culture. We need friends, we need a culture of friends to travel the path together. So, I just keep coming. I think to practice this path, you need to be coming every week in some shape or form. I have, pretty much, since I first came on a Wednesday night, when I was 24, 25. I came on Wednesday night, and literally pretty much I've come to a class every night, every week since then. Pretty much, I think that's true. I've had a few... Anyway, never mind. Don't want to sound too grand. In a way, that's one of the main things. You just keep turning up. So what I suggest is you're used to coming up. If you've been coming to this seminar for a few weeks, you're used to it now, so just carry on. And what they're going to be doing the next period of the class is exploring spiritual rebirth in more depth, especially this aspect of it being a super-personal force working through us, which I haven't managed to touch on very much. But they'll also be interspersing it with more meditation and ritual, so it will be more practice-based as well. There'll be periods where we're exploring spiritual rebirth and then more meditation and ritual. And we need the both. We need the whole kit, really, which involves thinking, feeling, acting, behaving, meditating. We need the whole kit to practice this path. And this path is... you can imagine this path. This path is both a path and a mandala. I said, I think, at some point in the seminar that the two great images for spiritual life is the path and the lotus. So you've got the path that goes from one place to another. That's, in fact, probably you could say the primary image of Buddhism. That's the image that the Buddha most frequently used, the path. And the other image was that the spiritual life is like the lotus unfolding. And I want to tonight explore the five great stages as both a path and as a lotus, or as I'm calling it, as a mandala. A mandala is a little bit like an architectural version of a lotus, with the open petals of a lotus and the stamen in the centre. Yeah. It's actually the ground plan of a temple with a Buddha figure in the centre of it. But one is a metaphor about time. So the path is a metaphor about one thing leading to another thing. And when you talk in terms of the metaphor of time, you can talk about how you need to do this first and then that. And then as you travel that path, you'll find these obstacles, and you need to get around those obstacles in this way. As soon as you use that metaphor of the path, you can use metaphors like that. You see? And that's quite helpful. But they're only metaphors. Only is not quite right, actually. They're metaphors. Metaphors are trying to tell you something, but if you're not careful, you get it wrong. You mistake what they're trying to tell you. You take the front of the metaphor, what it's trying to say, and you mix it up with the back of the metaphor, what it's not trying to say. So you start to think that there really is a place over there called enlightenment, and there are all these obstacles on my way, and I need to get around them. And if you're not careful, one of those obstacles becomes your own mind. So in meditation you think, oh, I've got my mind full of stuff again. How do I get round this? I need to just get back to the breath, don't I? I need to do this meditation on the breath. I don't need this mind. I've got this mind as a mistake. This is getting in the way. Do you see how that can just arise from the idea of a path? So there we are meditating, and we've started to create, our state of mind becomes an obstacle in the way of our practice. Whereas actually, spiritual life is about transforming our mind, not just somehow getting round it as if it's a thing in the way. Yeah? So this metaphor of a path, valuable and central though it is to spiritual life, indeed to human life, we forget that it's a metaphor, and we start to treat things as if they are literally obstacles, or as if literally in the future I'm going to be this happy golden Buddha, and that'll be nice because I won't be me anymore, and that'll be a relief. I mean, that'd be great. It doesn't work like that, folks. Yeah? It's taking a metaphor literally. And then we have this image of the lotus, and the lotus obviously is a spatial metaphor. It's actually rather more difficult to talk in spatial metaphors because you have to use metaphor much more. You have to sort of evoke them. You can't really say this, then this, and this. The whole thing about a mandala is, apart from its central point, everything has the same weight. You see what I mean? You can't then say you start with this, then do this, and then this. The mandala, apart from, I think, that central point, has no hierarchy. It's not going anywhere. It's just opening. You see what I mean? So it corrects some of the problems in the first metaphor. Yeah? You see what I mean? And therefore it makes it actually rather more difficult to talk about, because you can't say this, then this, and then this, and then when you find this, do this, and then turn left, and Bob's your uncle. You know what I mean? You can't do any of that. You have to sort of show it. Anyway, that's what I'm going to try and do tonight, is talk about those two things. And I wanted to start by talking about the lotus, because I wanted to come back to the Buddha. I've been trying to follow the Buddha's journey, because the Buddha's journey is a journey par excellence. It's the journey of life, of human life, completed. The spiritual journey of our life, which we were given at our birth, which I've been emphasising again and again, that human life is a great problem, a koan, which must be solved. And that great problem, that great koan, is the fact of death, the fact of old age, suffering and death. And the Buddha discovered the solution. Enlightenment is the final solution to life. And I've been trying to follow him, because we can understand spiritual life, human life, and remember, human life is a spiritual life, whether you like it or not. We can understand that, I think, much better if we keep on remembering the Buddha, because he exemplifies that life. So after his enlightenment, which is a mystery to us, we don't know really what happened. We've got these words: he sees through, completely saw through self. He saw that self was an illusion. He saw right through self. There was nothing there. There was nothing to be frightened of. There was nothing to get. there was nothing to do. He just saw right through it all, in a moment, probably, and saw right through life. And as soon as you see through self like that, then there's nothing to die. There's nothing to do. Dying is only to do with losing, isn't it? To do with losing me, this me that we're so terrified of losing. And then when you see through that, it's difficult, you can't really say what happens. It's not like you think, oh, well, I'll just go and die then. It's just that the whole matter changes in a way that's unimaginable, really. But you see, to me, if there's no self here, if you see through all that, like seeing through a window, your self had been a door, and suddenly you see through that, see that it's a window onto this vast landscape, what is there to fear? There's a lovely Zen story of it where you're dreaming, and the Zen story is that you're dreaming, and you're dreaming, you're thinking that you're being chased by a man-eating tiger, and that you and all the villagers are being chased, and there's all that horrible terror, and you can hear the tiger running behind you, and you're rushing through the undergrowth, and then you wake up, and you just think, oh, what a relief, I was dreaming. Like, you know, and you wake up, I was dreaming. I mean, that lovely moment of absolute relief. And it's said that that's what enlightenment is like. You just think, oh gosh, oh, I thought it was all real. I thought I was being chased by death, you know, chased by fear, chased by the nightmare. It's just a dream. Oh, that was a fantastic sense of relief. But then in this story you look back and you can see that all your friends are still dreaming. They still think they're being chased by tiger. Yeah. And you can see that if you could do that, all you'd feel was love. All you could feel was compassion. You just want to say, but you're dreaming. You're just dreaming it off. It's just not like that at all. One of the lovely images of the Buddha is that he's like the first chick out of a clutch of eggs. The first chick, he knocks his... knocks his way out. That was an impersonation of a chick. I shouldn't really do that sort of thing. And he knocks his way out of the egg, and he gets out. And you can imagine, you just think, good heavens! He's like really big out here. Because before then you were just in a little tight little warm little sticky thing. And you thought that was life, tight little warm little sticky thing. And if you had said, there's all this stuff out there, you'd think, no, I just said tight little warm little sticky thing, it's great. And then you think, actually, it feels a bit constricting. And then you sort of think, hey, help, there seems to be a hard bit in this little warm sticky thing. And suddenly, you get out. There's this unimaginable world, isn't there? It must be fairly incredible for them. But, you know, there's this unimaginable world, a new world that you've experienced. Yeah? And then the chick realises that all the other chicks are still in their tight little warm little sticky thing, in their egg. And then he goes round and he knocks on the egg. It's a lovely image, and he just goes round and knocks on the egg and says, wake up. Wake up. He tries to... He's sort of there. He's the principle of the universe. Spiritual rebirth, you could say, is the principle of the universe that's knocking on your egg. That's trying to say, there's much more. That this life that you've got inured to, habituated to, think describes its extent. It's just this little tiny egg you're in. In another story, it's a frog at the end, at the bottom of a pond, at the bottom of a well. He's just saying, look at this massive world I'm living in. And this other frog comes in and says, but it's a well, it's just a well, it's just rubbish down here. It's fantastic out there. And he just won't believe him. This other frog just thinks, no, look, it's fantastic, it's big, look how big it is. Like, I am the lord of this, what, you know. Look, world, my world, you know. So they're all sort of images to try to say what it's like. Once you break out of self, yeah? So, the Buddhas experience this in some way. I think sometimes these stories, these little stories, these little animal stories, somehow are better than some of the great metaphysics. They might give you a sense of it, just getting out of that egg, suddenly escaping self altogether. It was just something you can just leave behind. And then, who can say what happens then? But it's definitely nothing like we experience it now. Yeah. Who can say what happens then? So there you go, he's had this enlightenment experience. But probably, for a long time, who knows, I'm just sort of imagining into it, for a long time, there's just that wordless absorption in that. There's just this pretty incredible experience that is utterly new. Whatever you experienced before then, it wasn't it. You might have got tastes of it, but living in it, abiding in it, it's utterly new. And it's completely wordless. All the words you've had have just been about the egg life you had, just been about me and the, you know, this and that, and me and this, and self and world, and hard and soft, and all that. So it's just about that little egg life you've lived. There's no words for the world outside of that. So probably for a long time Siddhartha just sat like we were trying to just sit, but with just this incredible liberation, without words, without concepts, without analysis, without even thinking, oh, what was that? What's this? Just dwelling in it, just completely saturated in a new life. And probably for a long time he didn't need to move, he didn't need to do anything. He never needed to do anything. And it's said that, it's told in a story, it's a lovely story, there he is sitting, and at some moment, you can imagine, I don't know, a week later, a thought occurs that says, I'm never going to be able to communicate this to other people. This is so, this is impossible to say this. You must have been able to just think, at some moment be able to think, I can never say this. This is impossible, I can't say it, I can't. You think that thought arising, perhaps just the sort of tiniest sort of thread of that thought, because it wouldn't be the kind of thought that we have. It would just be a sort of tiny sliver of a thought that would just appear, and then suddenly you'd know the answer. Because you can't do that, you have to tell a story. So it's as if he thinks, oh, I won't be able to teach this. And of course, I don't think it could have been like this, but you have to play it out of the story. But probably it was just like a spark and a flame. And there it was, the answer, all in one moment. But you have to think of it as a story. So he says, okay, I couldn't teach this. Then he thinks, but what about those people that taught me meditation? Interesting, I think that's very striking. First people he thinks about is the people who have helped him. It's one of the reasons why I wanted to talk about helping people. He immediately remembers the teachers who taught him all they knew, taught him, not the Dharma, but taught him meditation. Probably taught him much more than that as well. Taught them as much as they knew. So he was immediately grateful to his teachers. And he immediately thought, oh, well, I could teach them. I know them well enough to know that I could say it carefully enough, and I could get them to see deeply enough until they let go of all that and they could see it. You know what I mean? And then in the story, immediately in that moment, he realised that they were already dead. Again, it's probably not like this, but he immediately realised that they were dead. So he thinks, well, I don't think I can teach people. I don't think it's possible. And then, according to tradition, Brahma Sahampati appears. Brahma Sahampati, rather unfortunate name, I would think. it would be nice to something a bit grander sounding than that. It sounds like Humpity Bumpity or something like that. Brahma Sahampati, who is the lord of the gods, appears. And there's this shout again that goes all the way up through the ranges and ranges of devas, like angels, going all the way up to Brahma Sahampati, saying, the Blessed One is thinking about not being able to teach. Again, the Devas always appear to say this is a universally important moment in the drama. They're there to attest to the cosmic significance of this moment. So he has a moment where he just thinks, there's no way I'll ever be able to communicate this. And that thought echoes throughout the whole universe, symbolically as it were. It's the most important, one of his great, most important thoughts. And it's such an important thought that the king of the gods, and it, you can imagine that as being, I don't know, the very deepest aspect of this world. Gods in Buddhism are part of this world. They're not part of another world. They're the sort of pinnacle of this world. That the pinnacle of this, it touches him, and he comes all the way through the universe and implores the Buddha to teach. He appears in front of him and says, please teach, please teach. Sometimes he appears with this vast retinue of gods all appearing like a great train behind him, saying, please teach. And he says, there are some with but a little dust on their eyes. Please teach. Interestingly again, that you have to be asked to teach. He didn't need to do it, you see. He didn't think, what do I fancy doing now? I'll tell you what, I'll teach. I think I've got lots to say now. You know. There's no will, there's no egoistic will in him. Do you see what I mean? He doesn't need to do anything. He doesn't even need to live, really. He doesn't need to do anything at all, ever. So he needs to be asked to teach. There's a metaphysical truth in that. And the Brahma has somebody who says, there are people with bit but a little dust. And then he has this vision. He has this vision of the whole world as being like a pond of lotuses. That's why these hangings are behind us. He has this vision that the whole world is a pond of lotuses. All the beings within it are like a great lake of lotuses. And some of those lotuses are under the ground, some of them are still growing under the water, some of them are perhaps in the mud, some of them are growing into the water, some are opening slightly, some are just starting to break the surface of the water, and some are starting to open in the sunlight. Yeah. And this is his vision of human potential. It is one of the most important visions of Buddhism. It is probably where all lotus symbolism comes from in Buddhism. At least that's what I'd like to imagine. And I think, again, quite possibly, it's an actual vision the Buddha had. Because, again, I think people are likely to remember the stories and images, probably more than the... I mean, I still can't remember lots of the lists myself. I mean, that's not saying very much anyway. if I can't, and I'm fairly all right, if I can't, lots of people like me wouldn't have been able to. But this story of Brahma Sahampati and the lotus pond, I remember it. I'll remember it to the day I die. So it's quite possibly it's something that the Buddha actually experienced, this vision of the lotuses. And he saw that there some people were ready. But what's striking about what he saw is he saw human beings as being all of them lotuses. He didn't see lotuses in a few little grubs, and lotuses in little pond worms, and little gnats, little water boatmen. Do you see what I mean? So there's actually a vision of sameness, not equality. So it wasn't that all of them are equally lotuses, if they're not equally open. I'm going to come to this, hopefully. I probably won't get time with this, right? He doesn't have a vision of equality. He has a vision of sameness. So they're all lotuses at different points of development. So when we look at the Buddha, we're looking at the Buddha with that in us at a different point of development. We're looking at a fully open lotus from the point of view of a bud or a root. So we're of the same genus. We're the same species. This is very important because in the Christian tradition which I come from, the assumption is that human beings are rotten to the core and they can only be saved by the grace of God. At least that was the assumption that I was brought up. The thing that we used to say, you're not fit to gather up the crumbs under thy table, I remember very clearly. There's even a sort of truth in that, but it's not the truth, it's not a psychological truth. It's sort of different country. But I think this vision makes it really clear that we're all the same kind of thing. We all have the same potential to completely blossom. Yeah? And what the Buddha does after that is he teaches for the rest of his life on the basis of that vision. That yes, lots of people are in the mud, and he meets actually lots of people who don't respond to him. One of the first people who responds to him says to him, "Gosh, you look quite, there's something about you, there's something a bit special about you." He sees him walking towards him. What are you? Are you an angel?" And the Buddha says, "No, I'm not." "Are you a god?" And the Buddha says, "No, I'm not." And he says, "Are you a human being?" And the Buddha says, "No, I'm not." By which I think he means, not in the way you think, no. Not in any way that you can imagine, no. Bhante Sangharakshita says that the Buddha is a whole new species unto himself. He's a Buddha. There isn't a category for him. He creates his new category in that moment, becomes a new species unto himself. And this man says, "Yeah, it's quite possible that you are," and then just wanders off. In other words, so yeah, yeah, I can imagine. It doesn't touch him at all. Other people who meet the Buddha dislike him, react to him. Traditionally, even people try to kill him. For some, he was a menace, a sort of social revolutionary, somebody who wouldn't go along with the caste system, for instance, a kind of social threat. And Buddhism, folks, is a social threat. It's a threat to the established order, and it's a threat to the established order now, just as it was then. It's just that our established order is a different kind of creature. So all he does, though, from then on, is he teaches. And he teaches because he knows that some people can hear the Dharma, that everybody has the capacity to hear the Dharma, that everyone is like a lotus. And he teaches, at least in this way of talking, he teaches, I mean, not literally, this is me imagining back this sequence of teachings into his life. He teaches the five great stages of spiritual life. So he teaches them, let's say, first as a path. But it's first of all, say, if he was teaching now, I think, he'd say, first of all, you need to be collected. You need to cultivate integration. You need to be one person wholly attending. Because without being one person wholly attending, you'll never go deeper in life. Your decisions won't have any real staying power. You'll decide to meditate one day and decide against it the next. You'll decide to go on retreat and commit yourself to the Dharma 1 week, and you'll decide to do something else the next. Without integration, your decisions to act won't be based on enough of you. There won't be enough making that decision. You'll be making a partial decision, and that means another self will take control later on. You see what I mean? Without integration, I'll grow in a weird way. And you do see this sometimes. I've seen people who've had very strong spiritual experiences and who attach to them, become even sometimes a bit intoxicated by them. And you can then start to try to appropriate them. That means you grow in this weird way. You try and grow round yourself. And that isn't growing. You sort of grow like a tree against a boulder. It has to grow round the obstacle, except for you won't ever grow properly like that. So we need, very often, what spiritual life, human life is teaching us, is telling what we need to start again. We need to go back to integration. Especially once you've had a deep experience, you need to go back to integration. Anytime you make a discovery beyond self, you need to integrate it back into self. Otherwise you'll appropriate it. Otherwise you'll try and make it into another special thing about you, which is getting in a bus and going in the opposite direction of spiritual life. Yeah. So there's no shame, there's no nothing wrong with starting again with integration, with self-knowledge, with coming back to who am I actually, what does my life look like? Can I live on the basis of my promises? Do I do what I say? Can I be a loyal friend, for instance? Can I stick by someone in thick and thin? Those basic human qualities we need to kind of come back to. I feel I'm still doing that. And in terms of the lotus, in terms of the mandala, we're always doing that. we're always trying to integrate ourselves more and more fully. One way of talking about this is that we're trying to integrate ourselves horizontally and vertically. So horizontal integration needs to keep going on and on. We need to keep on learning about ourselves. As you go on in spiritual life, it's not just that you... sometimes people ask me questions about myself as if I'm going to be somehow, I don't know, sort of specially Buddhist. There's going to be things about me that are really, really special and I don't have ordinary things in it. I'm sorry about this, folks, but it's just not really quite like that. As you go on in spiritual life, you grow and develop and you flourish, but you also, the scales drop from your eyes more and more, and you can see your egotism more and more. What's that saint's name? Saint Teresa, for instance. She thought of herself as being riddled with sin. And yet other people found her, light itself. They thought of her as being exquisitely spiritual. I can't remember which Saint Teresa I'm meaning. Do you remember? Saint Teresa of Avila, I think, but I can't quite remember. Anyway, look her up. One's not so good. So I don't mean her. but this saint, Saint Teresa, I think, of Avila, she experienced herself as being riddled with sin. And that is quite... don't get me wrong, folks, but that is quite right in a certain sense. As you make spiritual progress, you see how self-deluding you've been. You look back on your life and you think, oh, that was just me showing off. And then you look back on your life and that time when you made, that time when you made a stand, where you stood up against the crowd, you look back on your life and you think, that was righteous indignation. That was just righteous indignation. I was just in a bad mood. I had this horrible experience of this just recently. I was talking to you, wasn't I? And I was remembering. I wasn't talking to Sabatamati about her, I was talking about me. And I was remembering a situation in a council meeting of the trustees of the centre. I won't tell you how long ago, I'm hoping it's a long time ago, but it probably wasn't that long. When I really felt aggrieved about a decision we were making. And I remember before this council meeting thinking, well, if it goes through, I'll just have to resign from the council. This is just wrong. This should not happen, this decision. It's a wrong decision, and I'm going to argue against it. And I remember even waking up in the night thinking, okay, how am I going to... what's the issues? I remember all of that really, really clearly. I can't remember what the decision was. I have no idea what it was. Oops. You see what I mean? I remember being really steamed up about it. I remember waking in the night. I remember going through it in my mind. No idea what the decision was. So, hey, it can't really have been that important. You see what I mean? And as you progress, you see that more clearly. You see that was just me in a negative mental state. So that means you need to work on integration more. You need to keep on integrating. You need to keep realising, oh, what I thought was positive has actually got me all in it. What I thought was me standing against oppression was just me being righteous, self-righteous. What I thought was me being kind was just me feeling a little bit superior because I wasn't feeling unhappy at that moment. I don't want to cast this too negatively, but do you see what I mean? I do sometimes rather see things from this point of view. Anyway, let's get on to positive emotion. Vertical, that was horizontal rebirth, horizontal integration, and it includes lots of positive things, folks, but I seem curiously unmoved to talk about them. We'll have to ask someone. Anyway, there we go. Let's hope we get to something positive in there. I'm much more interested in the darker things, I think. Sorry about that. You'll have to colour it in later on. But that's horizontal integration, and that continues all the time. Because you see more of yourself, and because there's more to integrate. Every time you have a deeper experience, there's more to integrate. Otherwise, you're appropriated. As soon as you appropriate it, it's no longer anything to do with spiritual life. It doesn't count anymore, however great it was. But then there's this vertical integration, and this is really what this is getting at, is that within that integration, you start having experiences that go beyond you. I was trying to write about it in my book as being a bit like life is living on the top of a great ocean, And at times we get intimations of superpersonal heights and transpersonal depths. You know what I mean? That suddenly, a bit like the life of Pi, you suddenly start to see the creatures, the mythic creatures, the mythic depths that lie beyond and beneath egotism. You start to get experiences like even experiences that breaking into yourself, sometimes in dreams, in mythic experiences, in encounters with the mythic underbelly of life, which isn't yours, which doesn't belong to you, is a kind of transpersonal depth, the mythic depth. But then shining into that ocean are the stars of the superpersonal heights that seem to shine and glimmer onto the surface of the ocean of being. And they break in as well. You start to have experiences that quite transcend you, that aren't even to do with this mythic underbelly of life. They're to do with the devas, the gods. They're to do with that aspect of life. It's strangely that we're much less interested in that nowadays. We're very preoccupied with the transpersonal depths, with the mythic depths, but we've forgotten the ranks of angels. And they're there as well. Just because Christianity got them wrong, Christianity, as I said before, has tried to get rid of angels, but actually they're there as well. They're superpersonal heights, the stars that go beyond us, that shine into us. And we need to integrate them into our life as well. Yeah? So that's, in terms of the mandala, that's what integration means. It means horizontal integration and vertical integration. And that means that the flat plane of the mandala can transform into the lotus. It's like that flat plane becoming the living, opening, thousand-petaled lotus. The thousand-petaled lotus appears when horizontal integration and vertical integration are perfected, and they're perfected in enlightenment. That's what the Buddha is, the thousand-petaled lotus. Yeah. And then we move on to positive emotion. So if positive emotion is part of a path, on the basis of self-knowledge, on the basis of being recollected, on the basis of vertical, horizontal integration at least, we can start to act for the well-being of others. And of course the well-being of others includes our own. But it includes it, it's not motivated by it primarily. We can act for the welfare of others. If we don't do that, our love of others can be our bad love of ourselves, as Nietzsche said. He said our love of others is the bad love of ourselves. Slightly overstates it, because it's not always that. But without enough self-awareness, you can start to help others because you can't help yourself. I talked about this as a danger of do-gooding, which is really fussing about the welfare of others for egoistic ends, because you want to be seen to be a good person, a nice person, you want other people to think that you have sage things to say and so on, that you're that kind of guy or girl. Yeah? So we need to be careful not to slip into do-gooding, which is in a way one of the near enemies of this second great stage of spiritual life. It's really to do with expansiveness of consciousness, and remember, it's to do with acting for the welfare of others in terms of your body, speech and mind. So you cultivate metta bhavana, cultivating the volition, in other words, for the welfare of others. It's primarily an education in volition, and that volition, to the degree it is genuine volition, will fruit in actions for other people, especially actions of loving kindness. Yeah. So as a stage, that's the next stage. Having integrated ourselves, and the great practice of that integration is the mindfulness of breathing and awareness of the body and its movements. So we need to keep on coming back to our direct physical sense. Without that, we'll grow a bit warped because it'll be mainly heady. We need to keep coming back to that physical sense so we grow true, as it were, grow true from our direct body experience, not from some bright idea we've got, including a bright idea about spiritual life, and especially bright ideas about ourselves and bright ideas about other people. So once we've done that, once as we do that, we then start to reach out to other people. But then positive emotion keeps on needing to be part of a mandala of practice. We always need to keep on flourishing positive emotion. Partly, as I said in my announcement, because we'll tend to, otherwise, go back to the safety of me. We'll tend to become more and more habitual. And that habitual basically always means small, going around the little guinea pig wheel of me. Just running around that little guinea pig wheel of me. That's so deeply ingrained in us that unless we're constantly acting positively, we'll tend to just do that. There's no staying still. You're either moving forward or you're going back. So this second stage is the second great stage of cultivating kusala karma, skilled action. And that action is of body, speech and mind, and doing that ongoingly, always. Bhante once said that all you need to do is these five things every day. Just do something that integrates you, the mindfulness of breathing, the mindfulness of body, give to somebody every day. Bob's your uncle, you've already got those in your mandala. Every day you can do that. Yeah? Every day you can cultivate integration, every day you can cultivate positive emotion. And then we have the rather more difficult issues of spiritual death and spiritual rebirth, and I haven't even mentioned the fifth stage, which is where I hope to end, and already time is short. These are much more difficult to talk about. Our spiritual life primarily is to do with cultivating these first two great stages, integration and positive emotion, integration and kusala karma. The other week, I think, was it last week? I talked about this mainly in terms of karma nirma processes. That's the metaphysical background for that. That's saying that life is patterned in a certain sort of way that prefers the good. Where if you act positively, if you act generously, kindly, courageously, if you act for the welfare of yourself and others, you activate a law in reality that means that reality keeps on opening up to you. Reality flourishes when you act in accordance with karma nirma processes. Yeah? That's our great task. That's what we can do. When we get to spiritual death, it's much more difficult. In a way, I think we now get, talking to Yadavacharya about this, I think there's a sort of chasm here. Integration of positive emotions clearly practices. Spiritual death is a practice, but it's also basically an attainment. It's an experience. So it's quite much more difficult to talk about, and I find myself needing to correct this much more. From last week, I wasn't quite happy what I'd said about it. I felt I had perhaps got lost too much on images. I've also talked about it in terms of commitment, and that's sort of right and sort of wrong. So I want to try and correct myself a bit. So, as a path, the only way to think about spiritual death as a path, or one way anyway, I'm exaggerating there, one way, is to say that you've got provisional spiritual death, effective spiritual death, and real spiritual death. When we talk about spiritual death, capital letter, really we mean real spiritual death. And we must emphasise this, otherwise the great danger is to water it down. If we water this down, we water down the whole darn thing, and we actually destroy Buddhism. So spiritual death means seeing through the illusion of self. That's what it is. In that moment you see through the illusion of self, there is spiritual death. That's what it is. It's a mystical experience of the highest possible, deepest possible relevance. It's it. As from our point of view, it's the goal itself. It's seeing through the veil of egotism. It's seeing through the illusion of self. It's the goal of spiritual life. From where we are, it's the goal of spiritual life. It's really seeing through egotism. So in that sense, it's not a practice. And in that sense, frankly, it's not even a commitment. Commitment is another thing. Actually, despite the fact that I was saying it's a commitment, I'm now disagreeing with myself. In that sense, it's not a commitment. It's a it's a death. It's something much, much more serious. Is just too trivial a word. It's seeing through life, effectively, into death. But let's say you could see that you could do that provisionally, effectively, or really. Spiritual death really is to do with really, but provisionally, you can take it all the way back into a provisional practice of spiritual death. I think this is a bit better, isn't it? Do you think? It's a bit better because it means that it's much. I think it is more accurate. So provisionally, every time I let go a bit of myself, it's a bit of a spiritual death, a provisional death. So recently, I've been getting some feedback about myself. I was meeting somebody and talking. They were wanting to criticise me about something about myself. It was really rather painful. But it was true. I thought, oh yes, you've got a point. You've got a point. So when we do that, when you think, actually, I don't like this, I wish you weren't saying this, I wish it wasn't true, and you think, but I think it is true, that's a provisional kind of spiritual death. It might even be an effective one, but it's a provisional one. So every time we apologise, every time we want to push in front of people and we don't, every time we want to assert ourselves and we don't, is a death. It's a little provisional death. That moment where self rears up and we want to be important, we want to be the one that's noticed, we don't want to feel overlooked, that's a death, yeah? So that this death can be practiced literally in the simplest thing of apologising, which I think it's something we need to learn, to apologise, just to say, sorry, that was my fault. To admit things and so on. It can be effective, and what I was wanting to do, I think, is link effective spiritual death with commitment. Where you really say, actually, I'm going to completely commit myself to this path. That's an effective spiritual death, because in that moment, you've decided to move away from the world towards real spiritual death. Yeah. So that's, you could say, that is spiritual death as a mandala practice. There it is in our life all the time. But it's there either provisionally, effectively, or really. And we can practice it now. We can practice it in that queue when you're waiting and you're getting impatient. It's amazing. Even things like that still touch us very deeply, don't they? You're in a queue, you're in a rush, you're getting impatient. Here's a moment for spiritual death. Or something's happening and you're very prejudiced about it, for it, perhaps. You think this is really important, it must happen. And someone else says, I'm just not sure. And you feel yourself, no, that must happen. There's a moment for spiritual death. Or you're successful and someone won't treat you as somebody who's successful, as a somebody. I remember once when I was painting the mural outside, I'd been ordained for quite a while then, and we had an open day, and this other lady, I was eating sandwiches at the bottom, and this other lady came out of the centre and said, oh, you ought to go in there, they've got free sandwiches in there. She just thought I was a cleaner, you know. And when I remember when I was, I was, we were doing a sort of vegetarian sandwich company, I used to go around with sandwiches. After I was ordained, we were having this right livelihood business trying to sell vegetarian sandwiches. And I'd come into the office, these awful office blocks, and someone would say, the sandwich boy is here. I felt like saying, I went to art school. I've got like really interesting things to say about Titian. You see what I mean? It's a status loss. It's a death. So it can be a death in that sense. You see what I mean? That's it as part of a mandala. But then you get spiritual rebirth. So spiritual rebirth, in the terms of real spiritual rebirth, is pointing to what arises after self dies. In a way, it might be just better to leave it that. It's a gesture saying, this is what arises when self dies. There's this lovely expression in Buddhism called tathata. And tathata just means, it is just such. It means suchness. It's a word that's indicating something without saying anything about it. It's just a gesture. The word is frankly a gesture. So when someone said to the Buddha, well, what are things really like? He'd just sort of say, it's just such. It is such. And that's it. That's all I can say. It is such. It's a gesture. Do you see what I mean? It's just that it is as it is. It is such as it is. So that's the Buddha being metaphysically reticent. He just said, it is such. In other words, I can't tell you anything about what arises after egotism has died, because it's a logical problem almost. As soon as I try and tell you it, that means it isn't it. So I can't say anything about it. All I can say is it is just such. But of course, the Buddhist tradition hasn't been satisfied with that. Sometimes I slightly think we should. But anyway, we haven't been. So you've got all these pictures, metaphors, stories that are trying to evoke what happens after self dies. The thing I was actually going to go into, which I now won't have time to, is that probably the best one, or one of the greatest ones, is the five Buddha mandala, where there's not one Buddha, but suddenly five Buddhas. It's a bit confusing, because you think, hang on, I thought there was one. And suddenly we've got five, and they're all different colours, and then they end up having consorts and all sorts of things. But this five Buddha mandala, which you'll be exploring as you carry on exploring Buddhism, is an attempt to say what happens when self dies. It's as if you, just talking about one Buddha, because you then start to think the Buddha is just this historical figure in time and space, and you say, no, it's not. It's not that at all. You think, oh, well, it's the sort of archetypal Buddha, the one that might appear to you in your mind. And they'd say, well, no, it's not that either. It's a functioning of that. Look, I need to be able to start to invoke this, I need to imagine five Buddhas. And even that, it's like when you create five Buddhas, they end up with five consorts, and those five consorts have trillions of bodhisattvas. You can never end with trying to say what happens after self dies. It's like a constantly opening lotus. Yeah. So that's what spiritual rebirth means as a path. Yeah. It means the five Buddha mandala, the appearing of a universe beyond self. Which is constantly opening, a thousand petal lotus. It's constantly opening, ever renewed. Yeah. As a mandala practice, it means any moment we have, again, provisionally, effectively, or really, where we're in touch with something that goes a bit beyond us. Any moment of genuine imagination, any moment of discovery, where we discover more to us, more to life. And sometimes we discover, very often, in fact, almost always, we discover more and less. One of my great heroes is Cezanne. He discovered more in the few apples on a box than most painters have discovered in any picture of, trees and landscapes and flying creatures and elephants and the most exotic picture. He just discovers everything in an apple. He said, I will take Paris by storm with an apple. And he's quite right. He discovers everything in an apple. And you get this on retreat very much. It's where you discover that there's much, much more to you. There's much, much more to apples, to trees, to puddles. You name it, there's more to it. You discover it. Spiritual life is always a discovery. If you're not discovering things in life, you're not really living life. You're just doing you if you're not discovering. One of the great tragedies of a human life is so often we're, because of factors outside ourselves, there's no chance to discover. Sometimes people live lives that are just trapped in the machinery of the time. Although it's remarkable, even people in those lives still discover. It's incredible. You hear the lives of some of our Indian brothers and sisters, members of the order, terrible lives of poverty, and yet within them these incredible discoveries. I mean, remarkable discoveries, which couldn't have happened in a way, and yet they have, and yet now they're ordained. Yeah? So, as a mandala, you could think, I haven't thought of this like this before, but I think this is right. I think that you can think of this spiritual rebirth as the stage of discovery, the stage of imaginative unfolding, the stage of the new. Any time that appears in your life, when suddenly the breath is new, when suddenly your friend is new, when suddenly your mind is new, when suddenly the world around you is new. Yeah. And then there's a path. What happens then? Because the story doesn't end there. There's five. That's four. Even I can do that maths. So what you then have as a path is you have the stage of spontaneous compassionate activity. So the Buddha, from then on, all you've got is spontaneous compassionate activity. This is the miracle of the Buddha. That's all you've got. You haven't got a person being spontaneously compassionate. You haven't got a person being compassionate. All you've got is spontaneous compassionate activity. That's all there is from then on. That's all the Buddha is. It's incredible. One way I always find just thrilling about this is the Buddha had no views. So the Buddha, and he didn't need to think, he'd only think when he needed to. He'd just think for a bit and then think, okay, and then he didn't think anymore. People talk about this Aryan silence, this terrifying silence, I imagine, where the Buddha just had no thought, didn't need to think, so he didn't think. And he had no views. So if he came to teach, he wouldn't have any views, he wouldn't have any already, in other words, he wouldn't have any assumptions about things, he wouldn't have any cooked up ideas, any philosophies, any ideas, any theories, any predictive theories. He'd just meet completely freshly. So when he met you and you and you and you, he'd meet you completely new, without any assumptions about you, without any cultural, historical biases about you. He'd just meet you as you are now and respond completely spontaneously to you, to as he finds you, without without thought, without planning, without scheming, without organising. And sometimes he responds terrifyingly in the Buddhist sutras, in a way that you wouldn't expect him to respond. Sometimes he responds with exquisite kindness. Sometimes he responds with terrifying silence. Sometimes he responds with great philosophical discourses, with great metaphysical fireworks. Sometimes he responds with a tiny story, with the simplest childlike story. Depending on who he meets, he responds, and the response is to do with the meeting, because there's an ego on one hand, and there's a mystery on another. And when they meet, spontaneous compassionate activities arise, and that might be a little story, a philosophical discourse, a silence, a terrifying challenge, depending. Yeah? So that's what happens at the end of the path as a path. You end up with spontaneous compassionate activity and nothing else. As a mandala, what you end up with is spiritual receptivity, you could say. Or rather, you need to then reshuffle this, because you need to really put this in the middle of the mandala, you could say. That between integration, there's integration, positive emotion, between that and spiritual death, you place, as it were, this stage of spiritual receptivity, where you're completely just open. In the book that I'm writing, I'm trying to evoke this by writing a semi-chapter at the end of each chapter on spiritual receptivity. So there's integration, spiritual receptivity, integration, spiritual positive emotion, integrate, you know. So you're constantly going back to spiritual receptivity. So it's the aspect where we're just open to what is. And the practice associated with this is just sitting. You're just open to what is, completely open to the structuring of the universe, to a universe where apples fall and Buddhas arise. You're just open to that universe. And that, you see, is a mirroring of spontaneous compassionate activity. The Buddha is just, as it were, being himself. There isn't a himself to be. Language dies here. But as it were, the Buddha is just being himself. He's not trying to be compassionate. Him being himself, him just being open to the nature of the universe, means that when he meets you and you and you, spontaneous compassionate activity arises, with no person that it arises from. Yeah? So you see how it's the same stage viewed from the point of view of the mandala and our life, and viewed from the point of view of the path and the Buddha's great journey. And this is why we've needed, in this seminar, to follow this five great stages both as a path and as a mandala, and we've needed to follow the Buddha all of this way. Thank you very much. So thank you very much for coming, everyone, whether you've just come for this evening or whether you've been here for the 8 weeks. I must say that because of the atmosphere in the room, I found I've been able to say things which I didn't know, and it's to do with your listening as much as me to do with me talking. You can't talk if people aren't listening. You can only discover, and I think I have discovered things I've talked. It's really helped me with my book. You've really helped me write the book, because I needed you to want me to talk, for me to discover what I could say. So it's something we've done together. I've just been doing this end of it this time. Next time it'll be you doing this end and me doing your end. Yeah. Together we've created an atmosphere in which you've been spiritually receptive enough to ask me to teach. I haven't got much to teach as an ordinary human being, but here I am in this context with you, in this atmosphere. I've been able to discover things, we've been able to discover things together. So it's been something that we've created amongst ourselves. I've just done the talking aspect of it. I had meant to have questions, but you've brought so much out of me.